Chapter 13. You can rest down below if you want, Juan offered when Sloane yawned.
No thanks, I'm fine, she said, and yawned again. But I will take some more coffee.
Cabrillo pulled the silver thermos from the holder at his knee and handed it across, his eyes automatically scanning the lifeboat's rudimentary gauges. The engine was running fine, and they had more than three-quarters of a tank of fuel and only another hour to go to reach Walvis Bay. When Max had called an hour after they departed the Oregon to tell him that George Adams's helicopter reconnoiter of the area where the crazy old fisherman had seen his metal snakes had turned up nothing but glass-smooth, empty ocean, Juan briefly considered simply returning Sloane to her hotel and catching a flight to Cape Town to rejoin his ship. It would have been the logical thing to do. But now, hours later, and having a better sense of what made Sloane McIntyre tick, he was sure helping her was the right decision. She was as driven as he was, someone who couldn't leave a job half-finished, and someone who didn't back down from a challenge. There was something mysterious taking place in these waters, and neither would be satisfied until they learned what it was, even if it had nothing to do with their respective jobs. He admired her curiosity and tenacity, two traits he also prized in himself. Sloane poured some of the black coffee into the thermos lid, her body swaying to the rhythms of the waves passing under the hull so she didn't spill a drop. Still wearing her shorts, Sloane had accepted Juan's offer of a windbreaker, one of the two safety orange nylon pullovers that he'd retrieved from a storage bin. He had his tied around his waist. The vessel was stocked with enough provisions to last 40 people for a week, and a miniature desalinator to provide potable, albeit still a little salty, water. The bench seats inside the enclosed cabin looked like cracked vinyl, but were in fact soft kid leather that had been distressed to make it look shabby. A panel mounted on the ceiling could be lowered to reveal a 30-inch plasma TV with an extensive DVD library and surround sound. It had been Max's perverse idea to cue up the movie Titanic first, if the crew ever actually had to man the lifeboats. Every nook and cranny had been carefully designed to maximize the comfort and convenience of anyone forced into the boat. It was more like a luxury motor yacht than a life-saving vessel. She was also built for safety. When her hatches were sealed, the boat could turn completely over and still right herself, and with three-point harnesses for every seat, the passengers wouldn't be tossed around. And because she was owned by the corporation, there were a few tricks built into her that Juan had no intention of showing his guest. There were two positions where the boat could be commanded. Inside, near the bow, protected by the boat's fiberglass and composite cabin, or on a slightly elevated platform at the stern where Juan and Sloane stood so they could enjoy the spectacular sunset earlier and now the star-smeared night sky. A small windscreen protected them from the worst of the salt air, but the cold waters of the Benguela Current flowing north from Antarctica had dropped the temperature into the 60s. Sloane cradled the coffee in her hands and studied Cabrillo's face in the muted glow of the dashboard lights. He was traditionally handsome, with strong, well-defined features and clear blue eyes. But it was what lay under the surface that really intrigued her. He had an easy command of his crew, a natural leadership that any woman would find attractive, but she also got the impression he was a loner. Not the walk into a post office and open fire with a rifle loner, or the geek living in cyberspace type, but someone comfortable in their own company. Someone who knew exactly who he was, what he was capable of, and found what he saw to his liking. She could tell he made decisions quickly and apparently never second-guessed himself. That level of confidence only came from being right more often than wrong. She wondered if he had military training and decided he did. She imagined he'd been in the Navy, an officer,
but one who couldn't put up with the incompetence of those above him, so he quit. He had traded in the structured life of the armed forces to live like a drifter on the high seas, clinging to an old way of doing things because he was really born a couple of centuries too late. She could easily see him on the bridge of a clipper ship crossing the Pacific with a load of spices and silk. "What are you smiling at?" Juan asked. "Just thinking you're a man living in the wrong time."
"How so?"
"Not only do you rescue damsels in distress, you also take up their causes." Cabrillo puffed out his chest and struck a heroic pose. "And now, fair lady, I gird myself for battle against metallic sea serpents." Sloan laughed.
"May I ask you a question?"
"Fire away."
"If you weren't the captain of the Oregon, what would you do?"
The question didn't veer into any dangerous territory, so Juan gave her an honest answer.
"I think I'd be a paramedic."
"Really? Not a doctor?" "Most doctors I know treat patients like a commodity, something they have to work on if they want to get paid before returning to the golf course. And they're backed by a huge staff of nurses and technicians and millions of dollars worth of equipment. But paramedics are different. They are out there working in pairs with just their wits and a minimum of gear. They have to make the first critical assessments and often perform the first life-saving acts. They're there to tell you everything is going to be all right and make damn sure it is. And once you get the person to the hospital, you simply fade away. No glory, no God complex, no, gee, doc, you saved my life. You just do your job and go on to the next."
"I like that," Sloan said after a beat. "And you're right. My father cut his leg really badly on a charter once, and we had to radio for an ambulance, and I had to take the boat back in. I still remember it was Dr. Jankowski who stitched up the leg in the hospital, but I have no idea the name of the guy who first dressed the wound on the dock. Without him, my dad would have probably bled out."
"Unsung heroes," Juan remarked quietly. "Those are the ones I like." For a moment, his mind flashed to the wall of stars in the entrance to CIA headquarters at Langley. Each one represented an agent who had been killed in the field. Of the 83 agents represented, 35 remained nameless, still keeping the company's secrets long after their deaths. Unsung heroes, each and every one.
"What about you?
What would you do if you weren't a security specialist for a diamond company?" She threw him a saucy grin. "Why, I'd be captain of the Oregon."
"Oh, Max would love that."
"Max?"
"My chief engineer and first officer," Juan said fondly. "Let's just say Max put the grump in grumpy."
"Sounds like I'd like him."
"He's a piece of work, my Mr. Hanley. In truth, I've never met a more loyal man or had a better friend."
Sloan finished her coffee and handed the lid back to Juan. He screwed the cap back onto the thermos and checked the time. It was nearly midnight.
"I was thinking," he said, "rather than tie up in Svakopmund at O Dark 30 and possibly arouse suspicion, why don't we head south to where you met Papa Heinrich? That way we can catch him first thing in the morning before he goes out fishing. Do you think you could find his camp again?"
"No problem. Sandwich Bay is about 25 miles south of Svakopmund." Juan checked their GPS, estimated the new coordinates, and punched them into the automatic navigator. Servos moved the wheel a few degrees to port. A little over 40 minutes later, Africa emerged from the darkness with bluffs of sand shimmering in the moonlight and occasionally the brighter white of waves curling onto the beach. The long peninsula that protected Sandwich Bay was a quarter mile to their south. Nice bit of navigating, Sloane said.
Juan tapped the GPS receiver with a knuckle.
Gladys here gets the credit. GPS has made lazy navigators of us all.
I don't think I could compute my position with a sextant and watch if my life depended on it.
Somehow I doubt that.
Juan backed off the throttle to reduce their wake as they entered the fragile ecosystem. They motored for 20 minutes until reaching the southernmost edge of the bay. Sloane panned the dense wall of reeds with a flashlight as they tracked along the shore, looking for the cut in the grass that led to Papa Heinrich's private little lagoon.
There, she said, pointing.
Juan slowed the boat to a crawl and edged its bow into the reeds. He kept a sharp eye on the depth gauge and constantly checked that floating chunks of vegetation didn't foul the props. The lifeboat cut through the tall grass and the blades made a hissing sound as they scraped the hull and sides of the cabin. They had covered 70 yards when Juan caught the scent of smoke. He raised his face and sniffed the air like a dog, but couldn't detect it again. Then it came back, stronger, the sooty smell of burning wood. He grabbed Sloane's wrist so he could cover the lens of her flashlight with his hand. Ahead, he could see the orange glow of a fire, but not the contained fire pit Sloane had described. This was something altogether different.
Damn.
He gunned the throttles and prayed the water maintained its depth as the boat leapt forward, knocking Sloane into his arms. He steadied her quickly and tried to peer through the curtain of grass that blocked their way. They suddenly burst into the clearing that surrounded Papa Heinrich's island. Juan glanced at the depth gauge. There was less than a foot of water under the keel. He jammed the throttles into full reverse, causing a torrent of water to erupt at the stern and hit the release for the anchor. They hadn't yet picked up a great deal of speed, so he managed to stop the lifeboat before she grounded. He idled the engines, and only then did he take in the scene around them. The shack perched at the center of the island was a pyre, with flames and embers leaping 20 feet from its thatch and driftwood roof. Papa Heinrich's overturned fishing boat was also ablaze, but the craft was so waterlogged that the fire hadn't really caught. Banks of thick white smoke coiled from under the skiff and wafted from the seams of its wooden hull. Over the roar of the burning cabin, Juan heard the unmistakable scream of a man in mortal agony.
"Oh, my God!" Sloane cried.
Cabrillo reacted instantly. He launched himself onto the roof of the lifeboat's cabin and raced down its length. The cabin ended 5 feet shy of the boat's sharp bow. Cabrillo measured his steps perfectly, jumping off with his artificial leg so his left foot landed on the aluminum railing that ringed the bows and then kicking off from that in a long, graceful dive. He knifed into the water, kicking strongly, and came up swimming. When his feet touched bottom, he charged out of the water like a rampaging animal and ran up the beach. That was when he heard another sound, the deep bass rumble of a marine engine. A white bow runner circled around the far side of the little isle, and one of the two men in its open cockpit opened fire with an automatic weapon. Sprays of sand erupted all around Cabrillo as he dove for cover, his hand reaching instinctively for the small of his back. He hit the ground, rolled twice, and came up into a kneeling firing position, the Glock he'd stuck in his pants when he had gotten the windbreakers held steady in a two-handed grip. The range was 30 yards and widening, and he was firing into the darkness while the gunman had Juan backlit by the burning hut. Cabrillo didn't even get a shot off before more auto fire poured onto the island, forcing him to roll back into the lagoon. He drew a deep breath at the moment a round blasted into the beach inches from his head, forcing him to inhale the gritty sand. Ducking underwater and fighting the uncontrollable urge to cough his lungs out, Juan swam about 30 feet, making sure his hands were in contact with the bottom so he didn't reveal himself. He sensed through the water that the powerboat was coming around, hunting him.
He approximated their location and swam a little further, gagging silently as his chest tried to convulse. When he thought he knew where they were, he planted his feet firmly on the bottom and raised himself quickly, continuing to hold his breath for a fraction longer. The boat was 10 yards away, and the two men aboard were looking in the wrong direction. With water streaming down his face and his lungs ready to explode, Juan raised the Glock and fired. The pistol's recoil broke the lock he'd maintained on his breathing, and he began to cough violently. He didn't know if he hit anything or not, but he must have been close because the low, burbling engine suddenly ramped up and the bow runner made for the channel back out to the open bay, kicking up a rooster tail as she ran. Juan bent double, his hands on his knees, and coughed until he vomited. He wiped at his lips and looked across the lagoon at the lifeboat. "Sloan," he croaked, "are you okay?" Her head emerged from behind the cockpit combing. The fire's shifting light couldn't hide the roundness of her eyes or give hue to the pallor of her skin. "Yeah," she said, and then firmed her voice. "Yes, I'm fine. Are you?" "Yeah," Juan replied, then turned his attention to the flaming ruins. He could no longer hear Papa Heinrich's cries, but he forced himself closer. The roof was moments from collapsing, and the heat thrown off by the blaze forced Juan to shield his face with an arm as he moved closer. The smoke burned his eyes and sent him into another paroxysm of coughing. His lungs felt like they were filled with ground glass. Cabrillo used a length of wood to rip down the burning flap of cloth that Heinrich had used for a door. He could see nothing because of the smoke and was about to edge into the burning structure when a gust came up and parted the soot like a curtain. For a moment, Juan had a clear view of the bed, and he knew at that instant the sight would haunt him for the rest of his life. What remained of Heinrich's arms were still manacled to a bed frame, and despite the ravages of the flames on the corpse, Juan could tell the old man had been tortured before his shack had been set on fire. His gap-toothed mouth remained open in his final scream of life while the blood pooled under the bed sizzled. The roof collapsed in an explosion of flames and sparks that licked at Cabrillo before he could turn away. None of the embers could burn through his wet clothes, but the sudden surge of adrenaline galvanized him. He sprinted back to the water's edge and dove in, striking out for the idling lifeboat. Because it rode high in the water, he made for the vessel's bow and used the anchor chain to heave himself up to the deck. Sloan was there to help him slide under the railing. She said nothing about the pistol shoved into the waistband of Juan's trousers. "Come on." He took her hand, and together they jogged down the length of the boat and jumped into the cockpit. Juan hit the switch to raise the anchor. He firewalled the throttle as soon as it lifted from the bottom and used his palm to spin the wheel furiously. "What are you doing?" Sloan shouted over the roar of the engine. "That was a ski boat. They've got a 5-minute head start and can outrun us by 20 knots or more." "Like hell they can," Cabrillo said without looking at her, his rage barely in check. He straightened their course when the lifeboat's prow was facing the little channel out of the lagoon. "Juan, we'll never catch them. Besides, they had machine guns. You've only got a pistol." Reeds whipped at them like switches as they rocketed down the channel. Juan steered with one eye on the depth gauge, and a moment after bursting out of the grass, he grunted with savage satisfaction. "Hold on," he said, and hit a switch hidden under the dash. The forward part of the lifeboat's hull began to rise out of the water as hydraulics under the boat activated and extended a series of fins and underwater wings. Sloan was a second late to react. She staggered and would have fallen overboard had Juan not clutched for the front of her jacket and held her tight. The hydrofoils began to generate more lift and raised the hull even higher until just the wings and telescoping propeller shaft were dragging through the water. It took just seconds, but their speed more than doubled to 40 knots. Sloane looked at Juan incredulously, unsure what to say or how to react to the plodding lifeboat becoming a streaking high-performance hydrofoil. She finally blurted, "Who in the hell are you?" He glanced at her. He normally would have come up with a pithy remark, but his anger at Papa Heinrich's murder was all-consuming. "Someone you don't want to piss off." His eyes were as hard as agate. "And they just pissed me off." He pointed ahead. "Do you see how the sea is glowing a little bit?" Sloane nodded. Their boat's motion through the water caused bioluminescent organisms to fluoresce. "We never would have found them in daylight, but at night Mother Nature's giving us some help. Can you take the helm and keep us on that trail?" "I've never driven a boat like this." "Not many people have. It's just like your father's charter, only faster. Just keep the wheel straight, and if you have to turn, do it gently. I'll be back in a second." He watched her for a moment to make certain she would be all right, then ducked through the entrance to the cabin. He strode down the central aisle to where he'd tossed his leather duffel. He rummaged through the clothes and came up with the mini Uzi and spare magazines. After reloading the Glock, he jammed it back into his waistband and slid the magazines into his rear pocket. He stepped over to another one of the benches and activated a hidden button under the cushion. A catch released and the seat pivoted forward. Most of the space under the seats was given over to food and other provisions, but this one was different. He threw aside rolls of toilet paper until the bin was empty, then touched another hidden lever. The false bottom sprang open, and Juan lifted the lid. Inside the bilge space, the snarl of the engines and the shriek of the foils through the water were deafening. Juan groped for a tube secured in the bilge with metal clips. He got it free and lifted it out. Made of tough plastic with a waterproof cap, the tube was nearly 4 feet long and 10 inches around. He unscrewed the cap and slid an FN-FAL assault rifle onto an adjacent seat. The venerable Belgian weapon could trace its roots back to the Second World War, but was still one of the best all-around guns in the world. Juan quickly loaded a pair of magazines with the 7.62mm ammunition stored in the tube, racked around into the chamber, and double-checked that the weapon was safed. He recalled Max questioning the need for such a gun on a lifeboat. His reply had been, "Teach a man to fish and he eats for a day. Give him an assault rifle and some sharks and he can feed his crew for a lifetime." He climbed back out onto the rear deck. Sloane had kept the boat dead center on the feebly glowing wake, but Juan could tell they'd cut the distance to the fleeing bow runner. The microorganisms had had less time to settle down, so the bioluminescence was brighter than it had been just moments before. Juan set the FN onto the dash, tossed the thermos down into the cabin, and slipped the mini Uzi into its place. "Are you always prepared for World War III, or did I catch you at a particularly paranoid moment?" Sloane was using humor to try to get him to relax, and he was grateful. Cabrillo knew all too well that going into combat without first controlling your emotions was a deadly mistake. He grinned at her as he took her place behind the wheel. "Don't knock it. It just so happens I was paranoid enough." Moments later, they could make out the low-slung speedboat arrowing down the bay. And no sooner did they spot the bow runner than the men aboard saw them, too. The boat cut a nimble turn and started edging closer to the marshy shore. Juan eased the wheel over to stay on their stern, leaning far over to keep his balance as the hydrofoil canted sharply in the water. In just a couple of minutes, they had cut the gap to 30 yards. While the bow runner's driver concentrated on their route, the second man laid himself over the rear bench seats to steady his automatic rifle. "Get down!" Juan shouted. Bullets pinged off the bow and whizzed by the cockpit. The hydrofoil was riding too high for him to hit them, so the gunman shifted his aim to one of the struts supporting the foils. He managed to slam a few rounds into it, but the struts were made of high tensile steel, and the rounds ricocheted harmlessly. Juan pulled the mini Uzi from the cup holder, juked the hydrofoil to give himself a clear firing lane around her bows, and greased the trigger. The little weapon bucked in his hand, and a shining arc of spent brass rose into the hydrofoil's slipstream and vanished over the stern. Juan couldn't risk killing both men, so he aimed a bit to the side of the fleeing ski boat. The water exploded along its port side as 20 rounds raked the sea. He had hoped that would have ended the chase because the men had to realize their former prey was bigger, faster, and equally armed. However, the bow runner kept up its speed and curved even closer to the swampy shore. Juan had no choice but to stay on them as they zipped by clots of reeds and spindly trees. He soon found himself dancing the hydrofoil around strands of grass and little islands that dotted the coastline. What the ski boat lacked in speed, it made up for in maneuverability, and as they weaved around obstacles in the water, it widened the distance to 50 yards, then 60. Cabrillo could have turned to open water and closed in again, but he was afraid if he lost sight of his quarry, they would escape into the towering seagrass, where their shallower draft was the ultimate advantage. And to go in to find them invited walking into an ambush. He knew the best way to end this was to keep on their tail. They slashed past stands of trees, sending birds shrieking for the sky, and their wakes sloshing through the marsh caused the mats of grass to undulate as though the bay were breathing. Ever mindful that the foils were vulnerable to underwater obstructions, Juan had to make easier turns than the ski boat, allowing them to continue to widen the gap. Something ahead caught Cabrillo's eye. He had just a second to realize it was a partially submerged log. Hitting it would tear the wings right off the boat, so with a deft hand on the throttle and wheel, he snaked the hydrofoil around the log. The quick move avoided the log, but forced them into a gap between two low, mud-covered islands. Juan glanced at the depth gauge and saw it was pegged at zero. There was perhaps 6 inches of water between the wings and the bottom. He leaned against the throttle to eke out a bit more power and hopefully raise the boat a few more inches. If they grounded at this speed, he and Sloan would be tossed from the hydrofoil like rag dolls. The impact with the water would be like hitting pavement after a 50-foot fall. The channel between the islands grew narrower. Juan turned to look astern. The normally white wake kicked up by the foils and propeller was a deep chocolate brown as their passage roiled silt from the seafloor. The boat staggered for an instant as a wing brushed bottom. He couldn't slow down because the hydrofoil would drop off plane and she'd auger into the mud, and he had the engine keening at well above redline. The channel seemed to grow narrower still. "Brace yourself!" he shouted over the engine because he knew he'd gambled and lost. They raced through the narrowest spot on the channel, losing a bit of speed when the forward wings kissed the bottom a second time before the channel widened and the depth began to increase. Juan blew out a long breath.
"Was that as close as I think it was?"
Sloan asked. "Closer." But the maneuver had halved the distance to the bow runner because it had been forced to slalom through a stand of mangroves. The gunman braced himself at the ski boat's stern. Juan eased off the throttle and cut across the marsh to once again place the hydrofoil directly in their wake, using his craft's superior size as a shield just as a fresh fusillade poured from the nimble little boat. The rounds peppered the sea and blew out 2 panes of safety glass that ran along the lifeboat's cabin. A straight section of marsh allowed Cabrillo to firewall the engine again. In just seconds, the big hydrofoil loomed over the bow runner. In the turbulence of her wake, the hydrofoil began to ventilate, to draw air under the water wings and lose lift. Her bow sawed up and down, which is what Juan had anticipated. The ski boat's driver tried to dance out from under the crushing bow, but Juan matched him turn for turn.
The bow slammed down on the bow runner's stern, but the blow wasn't hard enough to slow it, and Cabrillo had to back off slightly to regain lift. He glanced at the dash to check the RPMs, and as soon as he did, Sloane screamed. He looked up. When the hydrofoil's bow hit the rear of the ski boat, the gunman had jumped for the railing. He now stood at the hydrofoil's prow, clutching the railing with one hand while the other held an AK-47, its barrel aimed directly between Juan's eyes. There wasn't time to draw his own weapon, so Juan did the only thing he could. His hand lashed out and chopped the throttle an instant before the AK blazed. He and Sloane were slammed into the dashboard as the hydrofoil slowed from 40 miles per hour to almost nothing in an instant, a wild burst from the assault rifle stitching a ragged line across the top of the cabin. The boat came off plane hard, and while the gunman managed to keep his grip on the railing, his chest was crushed against the aluminum struts by the massive wall of water that exploded over the bow with the force to douse Juan and Sloane all the way at the vessel's stern. The hydrofoil's forward momentum was enough that he slid under the hull, and when Cabrillo pressed on the throttle again, her wake frothed pink.
"Are you okay?" Juan asked quickly.
Sloane was massaging her upper chest where it had impacted with the dash.
"I think so," she replied, and raked wet hair from her forehead. She pointed to his arm. "You're bleeding."
Cabrillo made sure the boat was gaining on the bow runner before looking at the wound. A shard of fiberglass torn off the boat by the spray of bullets was partially embedded in his upper arm.
"Ow!"
he exclaimed when he felt the first flicker of pain.
"I thought tough guys could ignore a little thing like that."
"Like hell. It hurts." He gently worked the postcard-sized piece of fiberglass from his flesh. The shard had cut cleanly, and there was little blood. Juan dug out the small medical kit from a bin next to the dash. He handed it to Sloane, who rummaged through it and found a roll of sterile gauze. He held still as she wrapped his arm with the bandage and tied it off tightly.
"That should hold you," she pronounced.
"When was your last tetanus?"
"February 20th, 2 years ago."
"You remember the exact date?" "There's a 15-inch scar on my back. Days you get a gash that big tend to stick with you." In a minute, they had regained all the ground they had lost to the ski boat. Juan noted that the marsh to their right was giving way to a boulder-strewn beach that would afford no protection to his quarry. It was time to end this.
"Can you take the helm again?"
"Yes, sure." "Watch for my signal, then ease back on the throttle. Be prepared to turn. I'll point which way." Unlike before, he didn't wait to see if she was comfortable at the controls. He hefted the FN assault rifle and spare magazine and clambered up the length of the boat. The bow runner was no more than 5 yards in front of him. He steadied himself against the railing and brought the FN to his shoulder. He fired controlled 3-round bursts. When the first bullets slammed into the bow runner's engine cowling, the driver sheered away, trying to find shallow water close to shore. Juan raised his arm and pointed to port, and Sloane followed his lead. Her turn was a little steep, but she seemed to have a handle on the hydrofoil's drive characteristics. As soon as he regained the sight picture he wanted, he loosened another 3-round burst into the bow runner's engine, and a third. The driver tried to throw off Cabrillo's aim, but the chairman anticipated every juke and twist and slammed another half-dozen bullets into the boat. The wisp of white smoke that suddenly appeared from under the engine cowling quickly turned into a black cloud. The engine would seize any second, and Juan readied his signal to Sloane for them to slow so they wouldn't ram the bow runner. Between the bow lights on the hydrofoil and the ski boat's dash lights, Cabrillo could just discern the driver's features when he turned to look back at him. They locked eyes for just an instant, but Juan could feel the hatred across the distance like the heat from a fire. Rather than fear, he read defiance in the man's expression. The man cranked the wheel hard over. Juan raised his hand to stop Sloan from pursuing because the bow runner was heading directly for the rocky shore. Cabrillo had wanted to take one of the men prisoner from the very start of the chase, but he felt the chance slipping from his grasp. He fired again, raking the ski boat's stern, not sure of what he was hitting because of the smoke, but desperate to prevent what he knew the driver intended. The bow runner had picked up most of the speed it had lost in the turn when it was still 20 feet from the coast. The engine's shriek stuttered for a moment, but it was too late. The boat hit the shoaling bottom at 30-plus knots and shot out of the water like a javelin. It arced high through the night air before nosing into the ground and came apart as if a bomb had gone off inside its fiberglass shell. The hull splintered into hundreds of pieces, and her engine was torn from its mount as the craft cartwheeled up the beach. The impact burst the fuel tank, and the gasoline became an aerosol cloud. The body of the driver was flung 20 feet before the fuel-air mixture detonated into a mushrooming fireball that consumed what remained of the ski boat. Sloan had had the presence of mind to ease the hydrofoil off plane, then slow it to a crawl by the time Juan had scurried back to the cockpit. He double-checked that the FN-FAL was safed and set it back on the dash. After raising the retractable foils, he eased the boat as close to the wreckage as he could, idled the engine, and dropped the small anchor.
"He killed himself, didn't he?"
Cabrillo couldn't take his eyes off the burning boat.
"Yep."
"What does that mean?"
He glanced at her as he processed her question and all the implications his answer meant.
"He knew we weren't the authorities, so he was willing to die rather than risk capture and interrogation. It means we're dealing with fanatics."
"Like Muslim fundamentalists?"
"I don't think he was an Arab jihadi. This is something else."
"But what?"
Juan didn't reply because he had no answer. His clothes were still drenched from his earlier swim, so he simply stepped off the back of the hydrofoil and into water that came up to his neck. He was almost to shore when he heard Sloan hit the water behind him. He waited for her at the surf line, and together they approached the body. There was no sense checking out the boat, since all that remained was melted fiberglass and scorched metal. The damage done to the corpse by the impact and subsequent roll up the beach was horrifying. Like the vision of a demented artist, his neck and every limb were set at obtuse angles. Cabrillo checked there was no pulse before slipping the Glock into the waistband of his pants. There was nothing in the man's rear pockets, so Juan rolled the corpse, shaken by the boneless way the body moved. The man's face was severely abraded. Sloan gasped.
"Sorry," Juan said. "You might want to stand back."
"No, it's not that. I know him. That's the South African chopper pilot Tony and I hired. His name's Peter DeWitt." "Damn, how could I be so stupid? He knew we were going to investigate Papa Heinrich's snakes because I told him. He sent that boat to follow us yesterday and then came here to make sure no one ever questioned the old man again."
The repercussions of her presence in Namibia hit Sloan fast and hard. She looked like she was about to be ill.
"If I hadn't come here looking for the Rove, Papa Heinrich would still be alive."
Her eyes were wet when she looked at Juan.
"Luca, our guide. I bet they've already killed him, too." "Oh, God. What about Tony?"
Cabrillo knew intuitively that she didn't want to be hugged, nor did she want him to speak. They stood in the night as the ski boat burned and Sloan cried.
"They were totally innocent," she sobbed. "And now they're all dead, and it's my fault."
How many times had Juan felt the same way? taking responsibility for the actions of others just because he was involved. Sloan was no more at fault for Papa Heinrich's death than the wife who asked her husband to run an errand was responsible if he's killed en route. But God, how that guilt was there, corroding the soul as surely as acid eats away steel. The tears flowed for 5 minutes, maybe longer. Juan stood at her side with his head bowed and only looked at her when she sniffled back the last of it.
Thank you,
she muttered softly. For what?
Most men hate to see a woman crying and will do or say anything to make it stop.
He gave her his warmest smile. I hate it as much as the next guy. But I also knew if you didn't do it now, you'd just do it later, and it would be a hell of a lot worse.
That's why I thanked you. You understood.
I've been there a few times myself. Do you want to talk about it?
Not really.
But you do know you're not responsible, right?
I know. They would be alive if I hadn't come, but I didn't kill them.
That's right. You're just one link in the chain of events that led to their murders. You're probably right about your guide, but don't worry about Tony. No one on shore knows that the attack against you failed. They already think you and Tony are dead. But to be on the safe side, we'll head for Walvis. The Penguin didn't look like she had the speed to reach her home port yet. If we hurry, we can warn them off. Sloane wiped at her face with the sleeve of her windbreaker.
Do you really think so?
Yeah, I do. Come on. 30 seconds after clambering aboard the hydrofoil, Juan had them rocketing down the bay while Sloane changed into dry clothing from the craft's stores. She took the wheel while Cabrillo changed and broke out some rations. Sorry. All I have are MREs, he said, holding up 2 brown foil packets. It's either spaghetti with meatballs or chicken and biscuits. I'll take the spaghetti and give you the meatballs. I'm a vegetarian.
Really?
Why do you look so surprised?
I don't know.
I always picture vegetarians wearing Birkenstocks and living on organic farms.
Those are vegans.
In my opinion, they're extremists. Her statement got Juan thinking about fanaticism and what drove people to it. Religion was the first thing that sprang to mind, but what else were people so passionate about they would mold their entire lives around it? The environmental and animal rights movements were the next groups he considered. Activists were willing to break into laboratories to release research animals or burn subdivisions at ski resorts to get their message across. Were some willing to kill for it, too? He wondered if the polarity of opinion had been so sharpened in the past few years that societal norms of restraint and respect no longer applied. East, West, Muslim, Christian, socialist, capitalist, rich, poor. It seemed every issue could drive a wedge deep enough to cause one side or the other to consider violence. Of course, it was into this very divide that he sailed the Oregon. With the world no longer cowering under the threat of nuclear annihilation from a war between the old Soviet Union and the United States, regional flare-ups had proliferated to the point that conventional means could no longer contain them. Cabrillo had known this was coming and had formed the corporation to combat these new threats. It was disheartening to think it, but he knew they would have more work than they could ever handle. With no ransom demands from Jeffrey Merrick's kidnappers, it appeared more and more likely that his abduction was politically motivated. And given the nature of Merrick's work, the politics most likely involved was the extreme environmental fringe. Then he wondered if his kidnapping was somehow connected to whatever Sloane McIntyre had stumbled into. The odds were dead against it, despite the coincidental fact that both were connected to Namibia. The skeleton coast was far from the world consciousness when it came to the environment. Brazilian rainforests or polluted waterways, those were what people were familiar with, not a remote strip of desert in a country that many couldn't find on a map. Then he thought of another scenario. Diamond mining was one of Namibia's biggest industries. And considering how tightly controlled the market was, according to Sloan, the likely possibility was that they had stumbled into an illegal mining operation. People were more than willing to risk their lives for the idea of immeasurable wealth. And people committed murders for a lot less. But did that explain Peter DeWitt's apparent suicide? It would if he considered the consequences of being caught worse than a quick death. What would happen to a man like DeWitt if he was caught in some sort of illegal diamond mining activity? Cabrillo asked Sloan. It varies from country to country. In Sierra Leone, he'd be shot on sight. Here in Namibia, it's a $20,000 fine and 5 years in prison. He looked at her askance for knowing the answer so readily. I'm a security specialist, remember? I have to know the laws pertaining to the diamond trade in a dozen countries, just like you have to know the customs laws of the ports you visit. Well, I'm still impressed, Juan said, then went on, 5 years doesn't sound too bad. Certainly not enough of a sentence for someone to commit suicide rather than doing the time. You don't know African prisons. I can't imagine they rate many stars in the Michelin Guide. It's not just the conditions. Tuberculosis and HIV infection rates in African jails are among the highest in the world. Some human rights groups believe any jail time is tantamount to a death sentence. Why are you asking about all this? I'm trying to get a handle on why DeWitt killed himself rather than risk capture. You're thinking maybe he's not a fanatic or something? I don't know what I'm thinking, Juan admitted. There's something else going on that I can't tell you about, and I thought for a second they could be linked. I'm just making sure they're not. Understanding motivations is the key to seeing these aren't two pieces of the same puzzle, but two different puzzles altogether. It's just that there's a coincidence involved. And you hate coincidences, Sloan finished for him. Exactly. If you want to tell me what else is happening, maybe I can help. Sorry, Sloan. That wouldn't be a good idea. Loose lips sink ships and all that. Sloan was just being flippant and didn't know how her words would soon prove to be prophetic.